Blakely, instructor for the Seminar in Managing School Libraries at the University of Missouri. And I'm going to introduce Tim Hyges, who is the account sales manager for EBSCO Publishing. Good morning, Tim.
Good morning, Beth. How are you?
I'm quite fine. I want to tell you a few words about the students in my class this summer. There are over 20 of them. Many of them are teachers I have some who are interested in going into the school library field. I have others who are starting a job this fall as a school librarian. I have some that have started recently as a school librarian, and they're either working on their master's or their certification. I have public school librarians who have their master's but are thinking of maybe going into school libraries. I also have some college librarians. We are an online class. I have students from the state of Missouri. I have Illinois. I have two from Kansas, and I have one student from New Mexico. So we are all over the place.
That's great.
Yeah, so we're quite diverse here. Could you tell us something about what you do in your company?
Sure. My name is, as you mentioned, my name is Tim Hyges, and I'm the regional sales manager for EBSCO Publishing. I've been with the company for 10.5 years, selling various databases over the years to various markets, and currently I oversee all school libraries, public libraries, and academic libraries in 4 states, Illinois, Missouri, Kansas, and Colorado. And we represent all of the databases that EBSCO Publishing sells to those markets and within those territories. EBSCO Publishing has been around since 1987 in various iterations. We actually started off selling a binder called Popular Magazine Review, where we aggregated, indexed, and abstracted popular magazines and sold them to libraries. And then EBSCO Industries in 1987 purchased the company and made it EBSCO Publishing. And then today we are the world's largest aggregator of electronic content. And so you really, the world's best researchers come to the EBSCOhost databases to validate their theories and ideas and discover new ways of thinking.
All right. You used a word that some people may not know. You used the word aggregator. Would you just give us a little definition of what that is?
Yes. What we do, we aggregate. We bring together magazine content and book content and market research content and industry reports and all sorts of electronic content and bring it into a database that a student or a researcher comes in to find out information on, kangaroos or sequins or chocolate sodas or whatever, the student is researching. And they bring back articles relevant to their subject term or their keyword. And so we do as a database aggregator is we take that content in various iterations, academic, business, school, and so on and so forth, and sell it to libraries.
Okay. One thing I do want to mention, too, is that EBSCO has several databases that are part of the MoreNet resources that are available to the public libraries and public schools within the state of Missouri. Would you want to just address that for a minute?
We are so proud to be associated with MoreNet. We've been actually associated with MoreNet since 1996, one of their earliest iterations, and when they got their first funding for electronic databases. So for 12-plus years, we have had an opportunity to work with them, and all of the libraries in schools, publics, and academics in the state of Missouri, as well as 42 other states across the country, have access to the EBSCOhost databases. There's about 13 databases which we offer, covering from academic to school to public, where the school patron or the public library patron or the academic researcher can come into the database, whether they're in the library or whether they're at home or really anywhere around the world. And as long as they're authenticated, they can have access to this terrific content that MoreNet has made available to the patrons of these various libraries.
Okay, and as a librarian in a private school, I also subscribe to EBSCO because I feel it's worthwhile, even though we're not a member of MoreNet at this point in time. Okay, you started to mention about 24/7 access, which is important, but how does a school librarian set something like that up?
Actually, the school librarian could set it up a number of ways, depending on firewall and security issues at the individual library. We can do it by we could set it up by referring URL, set it up by user ID and password, set it up by a patron ID or a library card number, set it by up by IP authentication. There are a number of ways that that we can work with librarians to set up access so that the student can get into the database. We want to make sure, and we've taken every resource available to us, not only domestically, but internationally, because internationally, there are different ways of authenticating, that we want to ensure that all students who are associated with a school or a library have access to the databases. So any sort of authentication process we can work with, and with you know, depending on the level of technical sophistication that a library has, we will be happy to do all the authentication for them as long as they are interested in getting all of the content out to their students, and I don't see why they wouldn't be.
Well, I do know that firewalls do occasionally cause problems, but now you set up, and I know, for example, in my school, students automatically go in from the link because the IP is automatically authenticated. And then from home, they go and they have a user ID and a password. I, as part of our license agreements, and we do need to mention those, I cannot publish that on the Internet because this is purchased just for my students and their families. So what I have done, and this was an accidental happenstance, I had started out wanting to make a bookmark with the user ID and password, and I ended up making a wallet-sized card, uncolored cardstock, which I tell my students when they're introduced to the databases to put in their wallet, because being in an all-male environment, they tend to leave things around, and if it's in their wallet, they tend to have their wallets with them. And that way, if they have an assignment that they suddenly remember on Sunday evening, they've got their wallet and the password isn't back at school locked in their locker. I have another friend who prints them out on stickers, and she has the students put them on the back of their ID. So as long as you have some sort of system for your students, and then if anyone loses it, of course, they can always get a duplicate.
Yeah, that's a terrific idea, and we hear from librarians all the time on how can they make, you know, access easier for their patrons, you know, at public or school. Academics, a little bit of a different environment, but that is a terrific idea, and especially, you know, dealing with boys. I've got a 7-year-old boy myself, and, you know, that's a terrific idea. And giving them something laminated with all of the concise information right there so that they think, they as student or they as patrons think of the library as their first resource for acquiring information rather than thinking of Internet service providers or other electronic services that are freely available out on the web.
Absolutely. And I know my teachers, and I'm hearing more and more teachers are having students start with the database and then move on from there because then they can get the more quality information. Let's talk about the EBSCO Mass Ultra, because that is the one I believe most of my students will be familiar with and will be using. There, you are rolling out, or perhaps it did roll out at the ALA, a new version. One thing that's impressed me with EBSCO is how much research your company does into the user. Do you want to address that for a moment?
Yeah, that's something that continually, you know, is being with the company for 10 years, continually impresses me. We have very progressive thinkers up at our headquarters in Ipswich, Massachusetts, who are designing and evolving the interface. And what you're referring to, Beth, is actually a new interface that we're releasing on July 15th called EBSCOhost 2.0. And it takes a lot of Web 2.0 features, interactive features that users of the Internet are using to really aggregate and bring content to them rather than have them go out and search the content. So while you can fully see demos of EBSCOhost 2.0 at our website at EBSCOhost.com, what we're doing a lot of things with the interface itself. We've heard from users nationwide and even worldwide, that they want a very simple user experience. So on our basic search screen, we've actually streamlined the entire search process down to make it very non-intimidating, very easy to use for all users worldwide. Because if you think about it, our databases and interface is used in every college and university worldwide, most schools, most public libraries, medicals, corporates. And so there's a huge parity of education level, if you will, or familiarity with online resources that we have to adhere to. So we want to make something very simple for the user at all levels. So we've really streamlined the basic search screen. But once you get past there as a researcher, maybe you're going to find out information on, Beethoven, for example, and you go into the result list. What we've done with the result list itself, Beth, is we've brought up a number of new features that allows the user to start off very broad. So, for example, we're going to use the Beethoven search. And maybe my ultimate goal is I want a review of his initial performance of, we'll say, the Sixth Symphony. And that's what I'm looking for. But I don't know where to begin as a user. So I just put in Beethoven. What we've done with the interface is we've taken Beethoven as keyword and as subject term and narrowed it down on the left-hand side of the screen, narrowed it down by subject heading and by content type and by journal and by author, so on and so forth. So we can guide the user through. So we start off Beethoven, and then we, for example, we'll go into symphonies, and then we can go into his first, his second, so on and so forth. We hit the Sixth Symphony, and then from there we can see a review, and then based upon the publication date, we can look at, is this the original review when it was first performed? And so from there, I can get access to that individual review. We've also, on the result list, we've brought in images from our image collection, rather than users going out to the web and actually pulling images from a website, which essentially violates a copyright. We have brought together links to go to the outside. So if anything a library subscribes to that's completely open URL compliant, we can link out to. But that's been something we've been doing for about 8 years or so. We also are incorporating images from the embedded PDFs, which is really kind of unheard of, because what we're doing is if you're looking for a chart or a graph or an image that's embedded in the PDF, previously, because of the limitations of Adobe Acrobat, you as researcher couldn't have access to that chart. And if that's all you're looking for, we brought it up as a thumbnail up to the result list itself. And something that's really exciting that we are debuting with this interface is something called smart text searching. And that allows the user to take a body of text, whether it's a paragraph, whether it's a syllabus, whether it's a, entire article, plug that body of text into the search engine itself, and the algorithm that we run behind it weighs all the stop words, like the is's and the ands and the nots, as well as the keywords, basically your search, draws a relevancy between all of those terms and weights them, and then brings back results that deal with all those subject areas in a particular body of text. So essentially, your boys could get a syllabus from their teacher. Teachers could say, okay, here's the syllabus. I want you to read articles this semester or this year that deal with this entire class. Previously, Beth, students would have to plug in all of those search terms, kind of weed out all the stop words, put in all the search terms, and then bring back articles one by one on the history of World War II, for example. Now you can take that body of text, cut and paste it, put it into the search engine, and it's going to bring back all the articles that deal with all of the subjects that this teacher covers in this class.
Well,
really something that has performed well in our corporate databases, which we've added in, and now we're adapting it to school databases as well as public and academic.
Oh, I can see that being very popular in the high school level, especially with AP-type classes where they are doing those more in-depth research papers. Okay, we've talked about the higher-level searchers. What do you offer for elementary students?
There's a number of different databases that we offer for elementary school students. There are databases that just deal with books, like book content, so nonfiction elementary school content. There are animal databases where you can find out information about pandas or, any really lizards or any animal under the sun. There are newspaper databases. We also, our highlight of, or our linchpin, rather, of primary school databases is a database called Primary Search. And that is a magazine aggregated database that covers things like Ranger Rick and, you know, National Geographic Kids and, you know, sports content and things like American Girl and cricket and things like that. So primary users, K-8 users, can go into this particular database. The database itself is more graphically oriented, so it's not like our EBSCO host interface. It actually operates off of two interfaces called Searchosaurus and KidSearch. And those are more graphically oriented, so as to these students come in and guide themselves through the icons, whether they start off in sports or they start off in art and music, and guide themselves through the content. And it's very heavily image based too, that complements all of the content. So students at all levels can have access to this, to electronic aggregated content. And the good thing about it, Beth, is that every magazine and book and primary source document is Lexiled. And a Lexile is a number that is assigned by a company out in North Carolina that gives the teacher a number that is assigned for reading level. So if you have a sixth grade student who is reading at a 10th grade level, they can find content in there that deals with 10th grade reading levels. Conversely, if you have a sixth grade student who's reading at a third grade level, you can guide them more towards the Lexile numbers that, you know, come from a third grade reading level.
That's so good, because we have had a discussion in class about Lexiles, and they are becoming adopted by more and more schools all the time. Okay, we've mentioned all the searching that's going on, and I truly believe the elementary student needs to start with the simple searches so that they become more comfortable as they grow older. Let's talk about statistics that a librarian should want to obtain and how your company helps the librarian obtain the statistics.
One of the things that we offer with the purchase of EBSCOhost is an administrative module called EBSCO Admin. And EBSCO Admin allows you to customize the interface. It allows you to kind of, referring to the top of our conversation, about allows you to customize the authentication. It also allows you to do a number of things, including in that download reports and statistics. These reports and statistics are really what we've heard from our customers are really the best in the industry. They are in-depth, so you as librarian or you as administrator can download information on how many times a database was accessed, what time of the day a database was accessed, how many times a particular magazine was accessed. And that one is important for collection development. So, for example, you are thinking about subscribing to, Rolling Stone, and you don't know how much it's being accessed. Well, one of the things that you can look at is how many times over the course of a month or a year or 3 years, how many times this magazine was accessed. And if it has, you know, huge access, then it might be something that you as a library want to subscribe to and print. So these reports and statistics can show a number of different parameters that you as librarian or administrator define, whether it's how many times PDF has been accessed or full text, or how many times indexing and abstracting has been accessed, or really anything. Anything you want to know about the content in the respective databases that you subscribe to, you can have access to. And
okay.
The good thing about it is that rather than do it periodically, once a month, twice a month, once every year, you can actually set it up to where you go in there once, maybe in January, set up the parameters that you want, and then how frequently you want the report sent, and then that's it. We will actually run the report for you and send it to you in an email, and so that's it. The report comes to you.
That's one thing I was going to mention, because I logged into my school email this morning, and this is the 1st of July as we record this, and my June statistics were there. So, I mean, you were very prompt at pulling those together for me also. I like having them, and this is personal preference, I like having them emailed like that. I print them out, but I also save them because I have this still text here when things crash, and I've had that happen before. But I also like to have them printed out because then I can show my administrator how much we are using the particular databases. Okay, let's say you're a librarian and you have EBSCO Mass Ultra, but you need another database, and I'm going to just throw out history because that's what I was looking at this past school year. How do you help a librarian decide if that's the one for her?
What we do is we ask them questions and make sure that the content in the database, in this particular history database, is what they are looking for. So there are a number of history databases that we sell. The one that immediately comes to mind is a proprietary database called the History Reference Center, which offers, you know, nearly 62,000 historical documents, you know, covering from, you know, early medieval history all the way up to the present. There are, you know, nearly 111,000 photos and maps. There's 80 hours of historical video. So what we would do, it was we as a staff would talk with the librarian and make sure that that's the direction that they want to go in. Are they wanting something with just American history, or they want something with just you know, Eastern European history?
I kind of threw you off there. What I was hoping you would say is you would set up a trial.
Oh, yeah. Well, no, from there, and then we would make sure that the database in which we are both talking about is akin to the direction that they want to go in. Mm-hmm. And then from there, we would offer them a 60-day trial and send pricing. And then for that 60 days, the librarian, the students, the teachers, the administrators could all try out this database, and we would put it right up on the library's website for them, so all users would have access to it. So, yes, we would offer a 60-day trial.
Right, and that is good because when you do a trial, then you can really see how your user is using it, and you can survey them afterwards to see if it had the information they needed for their particular assignment. Okay, if you're adding a database, how does your company decide the pricing?
Right, well, pricing is different for different markets. And that's based upon the agreement between ourselves and the publishers. But for school market, is a flat fee for the school. So for an elementary school, the price is X. The price is Y for a middle school, and you know, for a high school, you know, price is Z. You know, just based upon the different databases and the different individual markets. For a district, we would take into consideration how many schools and how many schools that are in the district, and actually what databases they have. So, for example, schools here in Missouri have access via MoreNet to 13 databases. And if I'm a school that has access, that's a member of MoreNet and has access to the EBSCOhost databases, and they're looking for, and I'm looking for a new database that has some overlap between the two databases, between, you know, MAS Ultra and the History Reference Center, for example. And one of the things that we as a company philosophically believe is that we're not going to charge a library for any overlap. So what we would do is we would consider that Mornet has access to MAS Ultra. And for the overlap between History Reference Center and MAS Ultra, which incidentally is minor, we would take out that overlap content in the History Reference Center. Because we don't believe that, as I mentioned, we don't believe that you know, libraries should have to pay for the same title twice. Because we're not paying twice the royalties.
Right.
We should pass that savings along to the customer. So if it's a situation where there is overlap, we make sure to not charge the library twice for it, and that's how pricing would be based on.
Okay. One thing I want to mention before we sign off, because you did mention royalties to various publishers, occasionally when we're doing a search, we may find an item is embargoed, and we only have the abstract and not the full text. Could you just give a few words about why a company might decide to embargo a title for a while?
Yeah, you know what, it's actually not the company that's deciding that. It's actually the publisher that's deciding it. And embargoes are something that all vendors are imposed on. But and we don't like them. We know students don't like them. We know teachers don't like them. However, they are just a fact of databases. And we actually don't look at them as they're a negative thing, because if we didn't have the embargoed content, then we might not have access to the content at all. For example, one of the things that we make sure of is that our content, our embargoed content, is available with huge back files. So, for example, Education Week, we have full text from that from 1995 to the present with no embargo. But Education Digest, for example, we go back to 1990 to the present, and we have a two-month embargo on that. So our competitors don't have any access to that content at all. So while we don't like the embargoes, what do we do as a company? Do we try to get full text to that title from 1990 to the present with a two-month embargo, or just not include that content in the database at all? We feel that having access to Education Digest is more important, albeit with a two-month embargo, versus our competitors who don't have access to it at all.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And, you know, it is a fact of life, and so we do need to get used to looking at that. And you are quite clear, you know, if it's just an abstract as opposed to full text. So that is very obvious. Okay, I think I have covered everything I wanted to cover this morning. Is there anything else that you would like to mention?
You know what, Beth? Honestly, we thank you very much for the opportunity to talk more about our company. We appreciate all of our customers worldwide, because if it weren't for our customers, we couldn't continue to evolve and maintain and produce the finest databases libraries have access to. So at any time, please, any of your students listening, can email me at theiges@ebscohost.com, and that's theiges@ebscohost.com, and I'm happy to answer any questions. Any of our staff up in Ipswich, Massachusetts, is happy to answer questions as well. We thank you very much for the opportunity.
Thank you, and I appreciate you letting me have this interview.
Thank you, Beth.
You have a good day.
You do the same.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
This interview was recorded in the Sisselcast Studios at the University of Missouri-Columbia.